The court's next case is Yurt v. Colvin. Mr. Pausch?
Your Honor, I'm Bill Fouché for Kip Yurt this morning. I'd like to begin by articulating a kind of big picture point.
Because you're from Texas and everything's big.
Yes, Your Honor, except my time this morning, in light of all of the issues covered in the case. I would like to point out how some arguments fit together. And I think it might help the court write a very short opinion if you are so inclined. The ALJ's decision in this case, of course, setting aside all the legal errors that we've described in the briefs, the ALJ's decision is very heavily dependent on the state agency psychologist's opinion, Dr. Lofko, of course. And the parties don't agree about whether the ALJ acted properly in adopting it, whether she followed the law and the regulations there. And we don't agree about what it means. But I'd like to point out, before I enter that fray, that even if the court were to side with the agency on both points, Mr. Yurt should still win, and you need only three things to see why. In addition to the ALJ's decision, you need part three of Dr. Lofko's opinion, which is appended to their brief, and you need the ALJ's hypothetical. In part three of Dr. Lofko's opinion, the part that the agency admits the ALJ adopted, Dr. Lofko reaches two conclusions that the ALJ's hypothetical to the vocational expert omits. Dr. Lofko said that Mr. Yurt has, quote, episodes of poor temper control, close quote, missing from the hypothetical. And Dr. Lofko said that he needs, quote, environments where stress levels are limited, close quote. The ALJ apparently did not notice that, or if she did, she left it out or discarded it for reasons not articulated in the decision. And therefore, on those two very important points to the employability of this man with a very serious mental illness, the vocational expert recommended jobs that just simply can't apply.
Now, if the ALJ had incorporated all of the limitations that were set forth in the body of Dr. Lofko's residual function capacity form, not just his summary, at the end, would you be satisfied with the RFC and the vocational hypotheticals?
Do you mean if she had accurately summarized Dr. Lofko's opinion?
Yes.
And put that in the hypothetical?
Yes.
No, Your Honor, we don't believe that she properly adopted it.
If she had.
You mean, well, yes, but we don't believe, to put that differently, we don't believe that the ALJ acted lawfully in adopting it. And the reason there is, first of all, the weighing of medical opinions is kind of a comparative process. The state agency opinions in general, because they are non-examining physicians who have never met or interviewed or examined the claimants, they're at the bottom of a three-rung ladder. Mm-hmm. And immediately above that is examining physicians, such as Dr. Bingy. And then immediately above that are the treating source physicians. And in general, state agency medical opinions are disfavored.
Now, can you point to a consensus among the treating physicians on certain symptoms that you believe Dr. Lofko and the ALJ ignored?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part.
Well, you believe that Dr. Lofko and the ALJ ignored certain symptoms. But what I'm wondering is, he saw a lot of doctors, but, once or twice or whatever. But can you point to a consensus among all those treating physicians that, you know, of some of symptoms that were ignored?
Your Honor, yes. You know,
good.
From my perspective, there is not a lot of dispute between the parties about the nature of this man's illness and its progression over time. If you read the statement of facts in the two briefs, you'll find that they're really quite similar. There's, we're guilty of a little nitpicking, and so are they. But the key point to me is this man's vulnerability to stress, the fact that he tried to work during almost a 12-month period at the beginning here. He tried to work and failed three times due to the symptoms of his severe psychotic disorder, the nature of which is that he hears voices urging him to maim and kill. Those are aggravated when he's under stress. In particular, they are aggravated when he is in a work situation. And we find that to be a big problem.
It appears to me that there were a few factors that the ALJ didn't address, and one was the COPD, the second was the headaches, in kind of concluding that he could be in some type of setting apart from everyone else where maybe we would not have this interaction with other human beings, so maybe he would not react. But then in concluding that, not really taking into account the other respiratory problems that might be impacted by a janitorial position. Do you think that is supported in the record?
Your Honor, that's such a good point, and I'd like to add a couple of things to it. Not only did the ALJ set aside the COPD in a way that to us does not make a lot of sense, but she ignored his daily headaches, which are confirmed by two medical opinions her decision relies on. And while we all have headaches from time to time, you know, if you are struggling to maintain your insanity, debating in your head against voices urging you to kill someone, you can understand that a headache might add quite a significant amount to that load. And I would point out furthermore that the ALJ herself described that social limitation in a way that's different from the hypothetical, and this is most important. Her RFC finding, her residual functional capacity finding, which is her summary finding about the medical side of the case, she found that he needs to be limited to brief and superficial interaction with coworkers. If you look at the hypothetical, the only one of those two that's there is superficial, not brief. Now, those are different things. Superficial is you know, you maybe he's on the other side of the room and you don't have to talk. Brief is a limit in time. And it seems to us, given the nature of his illness and how severe these episodes have been, particularly in a work context, that's a very significant omission from the hypothetical.
Well, let me go back to something Judge Rovner said about the different doctors. It appears that the three times that he had to leave work, either be fired from work or leave work,
yes,
because of these outbursts, they were each time was with a different doctor that saw him afterward. Isn't that right?
Your Honor, frankly, my fine-tuning on the chronology there isn't what it needs to be for me to be able to answer that accurately.
Okay.
I'll take your word for it. Do you have a question?
And I have a chart of where I'm looking at each incident and who treated him. So it comes to my question of then when the ALJ was reviewing the evidence and taking a hypothetical, the language that was given to the expert didn't include the fact that there were these three separate outbursts that have been identified by three separate individuals. I think there was just one clause which eludes me at this moment.
Completely. I mean, one of the points we make, and I believe it's the second argument in the reply brief, is that there's not just the problem of the ALJ acknowledging and explaining the failed part-time work attempts. You know, the issue in a Social Security case is the ability to do full-time work. He couldn't even do it part-time, and he failed three times in that first 12-month period. And to overlook that is contrary to the part of the mental health listing, the 12.00 thing cited in the reply brief, that points out that this is particularly important evidence for ALJs to look at, and it was not. You add to that the opinion of the therapist, the non-physician therapist, Rochelle DeFrancesco, which we have identified as some of the most important evidence in the record. It covers the crucial 8-week period in which Mr. Yurt finally resigned himself after repeated failures to do part-time work, that he simply needed to admit that he needed to be on public support. And that was a heartbreaking decision for him that Rochelle DeFrancesco supported. And what her 5 pages of notes, and that's all we have from her, clearly indicate, that it was his withdrawal from the workforce, his exiting the workforce, his applying for public assistance, and his receiving first Medicaid approval that allowed those voices to become quieter.
I do need you to help me with this. You claimed in your brief that in October of 2010, he lost his job as a part-time cook after that physical altercation.
Yes.
At work. Then you stated that in March 2011, he quit a part-time cook position at St. Francis after he grabbed the coworker by the throat.
Correct. Yes.
Is the October 2010 altercation the same incident that was referred to in conjunction with him losing his job in March of the next year?
Let me tell you what I think. Mr. Yurt, as has been repeatedly pointed out in the treatment records and also in the opinion of Dr. Binging, is a very poor historian of his own situation for obvious reasons, given the nature of his illness. And it's not exactly clear. My understanding is that the three events are as follows. The first one was in May of 2010, when he was still working for the hospital and was found wandering the halls in a state of altered awareness. He was put on medical leave then for 10 weeks, no work at all. He then came back to that same job, and he had the incident part-time. He came back part-time. They wanted to see if he could do that. Right. And he waved the knife around. And then the third incident was the grabbing of the coworker by the throat. And the records, is my recollection is that the record is a little inconsistent about when it was.
Okay.
Rochelle DeFrancesco's notes, however, make clear that whenever it was, the decision-making had to do with the need to reduce his stress level. And it's clear from the hypothetical that that ain't in there.
Well, did the ALJ make credibility findings against the petitioner by, there was that one point where he said, I thought you weren't working, and he said, you know, I was at St. Francis when this occurred. Was there an adverse credibility finding made?
Your Honor, it seems so, and you can understand why. I mean, this is a man who has difficulty recalling his recent past, who has given different dates for things. The story that the record clearly tells is that he has a great difficulty with work, and that every time he's tried recently to do that even part-time, it's been an abject failure because these symptoms come to the surface.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fouché. Mr. Jodfrey.
Good morning. I'm Jared Jodfrey on behalf of the Commissioner. This Court should affirm the District Court's decision because substantial evidence supported the ALJ's determination that Yurt was not disabled.
Could you help me with this? What job? I mean, you emphasized in the brief that his hospitalizations were brief and he seems to recover quickly. But I'm wondering what job, particularly in the unskilled labor market, and he's unskilled, would realistically allow any employee to disappear without notice periodically while he's briefly hospitalized? I would like to know where my friends could get that job.
Well, it's important to, the chronology is important here in this respect, is that's not what happened here essentially is that Yurt had been misdiagnosed with a seizure disorder. It took some time to properly treat his newly diagnosed condition. But once that happened, what the record demonstrates is that after he had been properly treated with medication and regular counseling, that he was capable of performing simple routine tasks not done around large numbers of people with no more than brief superficial interaction with others. There's been, I think, some misrepresentation with respect to his work history here.
I want to go directly to that then, because I thought he had the wandering in the halls incident at the hospital in May or July of 2010, and then he is put on that medical leave, and then he comes back part-time, and it's already at the end of 2010 where he's back in the hospital hearing voices, having threatened a coworker, and he's been diagnosed with the bipolar disorder with psychotic features. So we're really talking a matter of months of part-time work, right?
Right. So the chronology here is important. In May of 2010, he has a blackout at work. In July, he's treated by a neurologist, Dr. Bott, who determines that he's been misdiagnosed with a seizure disorder. We need to wean him off his seizure medication, and he refers him to a psychiatrist, Dr. Shao, in August of 2010. He is reportedly fired from his job as a cook at Parkview Hospital in August 2010. That month, he tells Dr. Shao he was fired because he had been accused of intimidating coworkers. There's not a lot of detail there as to what actually happened. He returns to part-time work in October of 2010 as a cook at a school. In December, early December 2010, he tells Dr. Shao that there was a violent incident at work, but that he did not remember the details. What we do know is that he continued to work there for the next 3 months. He stops working on March 5th, 2011. The following week, he tells his therapist he stopped working because he couldn't handle the stress of the job. But there's no claim in the record that he quit his job on March 5th because of a violent episode at work.
But he does have the bipolar disorder diagnosis in December. He has another psychotic feature disorder in January. And all of these doctors are documenting also that he's angry, depressed, and irritable in February.
Well, what's important is that he basically starts receiving treatment in August of 2010 for a mood disorder that's later diagnosed as psychosis. Unfortunately, Dr. Shao, by his own admission, said he wasn't really certain how to properly treat Yurt's condition and thought he should probably see a different doctor. In mid-January 2011, he starts seeing Dr. Ogu, and at that point begins receiving the treatment he needs for his condition. Dr. Ogu determines that there needs to be a significant adjustment in his medications. He weans him off certain antipsychotics, adjusts the dosage of others, and introduces some new medication. In the ensuing months, some additional adjustments are made, but by the spring of 2011, around April or May, the record is clear that his symptoms are now largely controlled and effectively treated with medication and regular counseling.
So Dr. Bingi says on April 13th, he's poorly groomed, long-term memory is poor, he's isolated, quality of life is poor.
And the ALJ addressed that doctor's opinion and said that it appeared to be an outlier with respect to the evaluations that were performed by Dr. Ogu in January, by his own therapist, and by Dr. Ogu again in July. In July 2011, Dr. Ogu reports that the medication is effective. This is his treating psychiatrist. It is effective in treating his condition. So we have essentially really one incident of rage in the workplace that takes place in August 2010 before he's receiving treatment for psychosis.
There are at least two in the record.
There is an additional...
At least.
There's only one instance where he loses his job as a result of some sort of incident in the workplace. There's a report of an incident in December. He doesn't remember the details of it, and he still works there for the next 3 months. So if he held a knife to his coworker in early December 2010, it seems unlikely that they'd let him work there for the next 3 months.
Why? Maybe they wanted that worker killed. Did Dr. Lovko anywhere discuss in his reports Yurt's violent behavior in the workplace or explain why those outbursts would not prevent him from succeeding in the workplace. Because if she, I mean, if that's there, I missed it.
No, there's no discussion of that specifically, and here's the thing. Those instances, the August 2010, is before he even begins receiving treatment for psychosis. The December 10th report, he's being treated by Dr. Shao, who, by his own admission, isn't really sure what he's doing. It's in January around January 19th, 2011, that he starts to receive proper treatment for his condition. The doctor starts prescribing him the correct effective type and dosage of antipsychotic medication, and has him enrolled in regular counseling beginning in February. The counseling notes, which are referred to by Yurt, show that improvement. In February 2011, he's described as being in acute distress. By May 2011, the therapy notes show that he's in only mild distress, and by November 2011, he's not described as being in any distress at all.
Earlier, you mentioned that when he said certain things occurred at work, as if to say that's the only source of information that he threatened a coworker, did the ALJ make credibility findings and reject his own self-reporting of those outbursts at work?
Not specifically to those outbursts. The ALJ did make a credibility finding that Yurt's presentation and his subjective allegations of disability were not entirely credible. And that's a credibility finding that this court affords a great weight and deference and is only to be overturned if it's patently wrong. It's only patently wrong if there's lacking any explanation or basis, and we don't have that here. This court does not reweigh the evidence or substitute its judgment for the ALJ's determination with respect to the weight of the evidence.
Yeah, but, and the resulting assessment still has to incorporate all of the limitations. In other words, even if we assume that Dr. Lovecoat translated his findings into a specific RFC assessment, the resulting assessment still has to incorporate all of the limitations that he had identified in his original report. And we don't have that here. And the ALJ accepted this hook, line, and sinker.
Now, the ALJ actually did a more than adequate job of discussing the medical evidence in this case. The ALJ found...
Well, that is your view. I understand that, but...
The ALJ considered the entire medical record and found that Dr. Lovecoe's May 2011 assessment of Yurt's functional capacity was consistent with the overall record. That opinion was affirmed in August of 2011 by Dr. Larson. The ALJ did incorporate those actual functional limitations into his RFC finding.
Here's something that I really do wonder about, not just in this case, but I kind of wonder about it a lot. Assuming that Yurt would be able to find and successfully hold down one of the jobs, that were identified, does the vocational expert or the ALJ have any obligation to consider whether he would actually be hired, given his violent behavior at his last places of employment? I just keep wondering, would anyone in his right or her right mind hire someone that holds knives and people by the throat? And I'm at a loss here. I'm just at a terrible loss.
Again, the difference being here that the incidents that are being referred to are his condition in an untreated state. That once he's receiving a proper medical attention to his conditions, the proper proper medication that's prescribed by Dr. Ogu, and proper regular bi-monthly, bi-weekly, counseling, his condition improves significantly. He concedes his condition improves significantly by the spring of 2011.
Well, he concedes that once he's not working anymore,
sure,
the stress level is gone, and, he can function he can sort of function.
Sure. What we have here is once his condition is being properly treated, we have no more instances of him reporting auditory hallucinations. We have no more blackouts.
What if he
missed? We have no more homicidal ideation. We have no more documented instances of rage.
What if he missed his medication once and went to work in that kitchen that they said he could work in with all the knives and cleavers and heaven only knows what else is going on in that kitchen around?
What the commissioner is interested in is Yurt's condition, when properly treated, and if largely effectively controlled with treatment, is this person disabled? And the answer to that question is no. Now, you're right. Yurt does both agree with the commissioner that by the spring of 2011, his condition had improved significantly. He has a different interpretation as to why that is. But we have medical sources throughout the record that attribute that improvement to proper medical therapy and medication. Now, even assuming that his subjective interpretation of the record were on an equal par with the reports of his treating psychiatrist and his counselors and his treating physician and his own self-reports that if medication is helping him, he reports that in December. His wife reports it in July to the agency. Even if these things were on equal footing, it's the ALJ's job. You know, the resolution of competing arguments based on the record is for the ALJ, not this court.
If she has looked at all the facts in the record and included those, and she did not.
The ALJ.
And should we not have some fear, all of us, that if indeed he does go back, you know, to work in this kitchen, for instance, that something really terrible will happen?
The commissioner's concern, the issue before this court is, does substantial evidence support the commissioner's finding that he's not disabled? We're not here to speculate as to if he went off his medication, if other things took place in his life in the future. There's a limited time frame that we're examining. During this time frame, did he meet the durational requirement, the 12-month durational requirement, where he can establish that he was disabled? That's the question that we're answering here.
But is there
not speculating as to...
I'll speculate all I wish. Thank you. Is there any evidence in the record that Dr. Lovko saw and considered the much lower GAF scores that Yurt received, both before and after his highest GAF score of 60? Because if it's there, I missed it.
There's no specific reference to the particular GAF scores.
Right.
As to the ALJ's discussion of the evidence, the ALJ is required to, you know, need only provide an adequate discussion of the issues. And here, the ALJ more than meets her burden, her minimal burden, of addressing the issues and providing a place for this court to be able to trace the reasoning of why it is she found that he was not disabled. Essentially, what we have here again is the ALJ explained is in an untreated state, he had significant problems. The ALJ acknowledges that. But once properly treated with medication and counseling, his symptoms improved to the point that he was not, in fact, disabled.
Mr. Jaffe, may I just ask you one question? the administrative law judge speaks on 19 of the appendix. It's 11 of the... her opinion, that Dr. Bingi diagnosed psychotic disorder and anxiety disorder and ruled out, that's under quotes, a diagnosis of paranoid schizophrenia and a amnestic disorder were noted. Later on that same page, she says, no treating source has offered an opinion as to the claimant's mental capacity, and then finishes that thought with, as discussed above, symptoms have improved during the period. Is there a little inconsistency there? Didn't Bingi, Dr. Bingi, offer an opinion on some mental capacity?
Dr. Bingi did have a number of diagnoses, but what the ALJ was saying that what we have here is the state agency room physicians actually have provided an assessment of Yurt's functional capacity, an assessment that this court has found provides substantial evidentiary support in the past for the ALJ's determination, and that no other treating or examining physician offered an assessment of essentially, despite his impairments, what was Yurt capable of, that the only opinion we have of that is the opinions provided by doctors Loveco and Larson, and there are no contrary medical opinions in the record. And as this court has in the past found that when you have that type of situation, it's reasonable for the ALJ to rely on those opinions, and those opinions provide substantial evidentiary support for the ALJ's decision.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Joffrey.
In closing, we ask that the court affirm the district court's decision.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Fouché?
Thank you, Your Honor. As I was listening to the presentation of the commissioner, two cases sprung into my mind that I want to mention briefly. One is this court's opinion in Spiva v. Astru, which explains why his description of the overarching issue in the case is incorrect. It is not sufficient for the ALJ, for the commissioner to simply cherry-pick evidence and weave it together into something that is substantial. The deference this court owes to the ALJ's factual findings must be earned by the ALJ's compliance with law. And if there are legal errors, then the court should reverse unless it can say with great confidence that the result would be the same on remand. The second case that comes to mind is the Scott v. Astru case, which we discuss at length in the reply brief. Scott was a situation of medical improvement, like he claims this is, and of course it is to a degree. But what the court said in Scott is that there is a vast difference between someone who, a mentally ill person who responds to treatment. May I finish my thought, Your Honor?
That indicates you have a minute left.
Good. Thanks. There's a vast difference between someone who responds to treatment and someone who is able to work full time. And that's the key thing. And the ALJ's decision really does not address that properly. The other thing is, what he's defending is this idea of cherry-picking treatment notes and weaving together a narrative that supports the idea that the guy's a lot better. Scott takes that in the teeth and says you can't do that. You can't cherry-pick treatment records because that's hypothesizing as a layman. And the court held in Wilder that the people who are the experts in mental illness and its effects and the ability to work are the psychiatrists and the psychologists, not the lawyers and not the ALJ.
Mr. Fouché, is that what's missing in this record, a significant analysis of his mental condition?
Your Honor, yes, and I would
say...
And
why is that? Is that just because an inability to reach that type of medical expertise? I mean, that's what I find in this record a little lacking, that we don't have more help on the mental condition.
I'm not sure I'm understanding the question. I'm a little hard of hearing.
Would you say this record is inadequate in assessing his mental capacity?
I'm a little torn. What I would say to the court is that if that is your conclusion, and I believe, frankly, that the duty to develop the evidence fully and fairly may have been breached here if the ALJ had the concerns that the commissioner says she had, I think she should have asked those treating doctors the specific questions and had them elaborate on the concerns. Or, if they're going to send them out to a consultative examiner, such as Dr. Benji in this case, it would be nice if they would hire some who would provide the kind of questionnaire answers that the commissioner's insisting that they have. They paid that man, Dr. Benji. And if the format of his opinion wasn't perfect, whose fault is that?
All right.
One last thing. A little point made in the reply brief that is of importance. In SSR 96-8P, it gives the ALJ the obligation to explain how ambiguities in the medical opinions were addressed and resolved. Given all the things Dr. Loveco said that did not make it into the hypothetical at all, you would think that should have been addressed if this were to serve as an accurate and logical bridge. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Fouché. Thank you, Mr. Joffrey. The case is taken.